Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. On June 2nd of this year, the Federal Communications Commission revised its rules allowing further concentration of media ownership. This has been a major issue with Congress in the last couple of months since the ruling, and actually a judge has put a temporary stay on the rules by the FCC. Many people have weighed in on this issue with Congress. Over 300,000 signatures were gathered in recent weeks supporting a reversal of the FCC's ruling. And groups ranging from the Consumers Union to the National Rifle Association have opposed the FCC's ruling. It is the subject of a vote in the Senate this morning, which essentially voted to turn back the FCC's ruling. We're going to talk this morning about that, what is next, with a man who has been following this very closely for some time. Robert McChesney is a professor at the University of Illinois Institute of Communications Research. He's also the author of several very key books on the subject of media and democracy. We'll talk with him during this hour and take your questions as well. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Bob McChesney, good morning.
Welcome, Jack.
Let's get right to it. What happened in the Senate this morning?
Well, this morning the Senate voted in what's called a resolution of disapproval. This was a mechanism introduced by Newt Gingrich and the Republicans in the mid-1990s after the 1994 Republican sweep. And it's a resolution that basically overturns what an agency does. And it's something that was specially set up, so it can't be filibustered. It's a majority vote wins. And the Senate voted on the June 2nd media rules relaxation by the Federal Communications Commission on the whole package. And it voted to overturn the entire thing by a 55-40 vote this morning. So it was a stunning victory. And frankly, 6 months ago, someone had predicted something like this would have ever come to a vote in the floor of the Senate.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have thought you've gotten 5 or 10 votes. It's
right.
Really quite shocking.
Well, so there's been an outpouring of citizen communication to Congress on this.
Yeah, it's been amazing. Now, first of all, let's let listeners know what the issues are.
Okay.
The issues that were in play would basically allow big media companies to buy much more media than they currently have. And the reason why we have media ownership restrictions in the United States is that our radio and TV channels that the government gives licenses to at no charge, the government gives monopoly licenses to companies. So they're the only one that's allowed to use a frequency. And the deal is that when you give these monopoly radio and TV licenses to a company like the Tribune Company, which has WGN, you're giving them an immense amount of market power. They're going to make a lot of money. And you're getting it in public property. You're not paying the government or the people of the country one penny for it. So it's corporate welfare. So the deal was, if you're going to give these commercial interests this amazing amount of market power so they can get rich, then what you want to do is not let them use the profits they make from those monopoly licenses to buy up all the other media. So you only have one media company in a city or only a few in the nation. So the government put strict limits. If you get these monopoly licenses from the government for radio and TV channels, you aren't allowed to also own the newspaper in your community. There's only so many radio and TV channels you can buy. We don't need buying up everyone in the country because it's not healthy for democracy to have media concentration. That's been sort of a bedrock principle. And the big media companies hate this. They've hated it forever. For rational reasons. They want to get bigger. They have less risk. They make more profit. I mean, that's where all the money is. Especially the money in media comes if you can go into a town and you can buy the one daily newspaper, and almost every American city only has one. You can buy two or three TV stations and buy eight radio stations. Then the cash register sings like Beethoven in your ears, because then all of a sudden, do you need 10 newsrooms to service those radio, TV stations, and newspapers? That's cost inefficient. One newsroom can serve all of them. You go out to advertisers, and you've got much more market power over them. What do they don't have a lot of options. You own all the advertising outlets. You can raise your rates. And then listeners, viewers, readers don't have any competitive options. They don't like the news. They're getting tough beans. You own everything. This is really sort of the promised land for these media companies like the Tribune Company. That's what they want. It's great for them, but it's bad for everyone else. They've been pushing for years to try to get these ownership rules relaxed so they could build out their empires and have less competition. And they face tremendous opposition from small media owners who know they'll get crushed if this happens. They can't survive in that marketplace. And also from the general population, which I think rightfully understands this is not a very good idea for democracy. In a free society, you always err on the side of having too many voices, too much media. If there's a gray area at all, you never err on the side of, let's just have one company own everything. What the heck? We'll roll the dice. Because once you do that, you know, you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube. You know, you just don't take chances on that one. And so that's sort of the background we have. And on June 2nd, the Federal Communications Commission waived its most important rule, which is called the cross-ownership rule, which prevented the companies that got these monopoly TV licenses in a community from owning the local newspaper. And, you know, people say, well, what about Chicago? Doesn't the Tribune Company, they own the Tribune and they've got WGN. Well, there are a handful of places that this cross-ownership is grandfathered in and existed, like Chicago and a few other cities. But most places in the country, including Champaign-Urbana, it is not permitted until June 2nd. Now, what happened this year, and this is where the politics gets interesting, Jack, is that traditionally the way these media FCC rulings and media ownership rules are determined in Congress at the SEC is done, no one in the public knows anything about it. It's behind closed doors. It doesn't get any press coverage, except maybe in the business press, where it's covered exclusively as a story of interest to investors and owners and advertisers, never as a story that's of interest to general people, citizens, or even consumers. And what happened this year, for reasons that no one's really quite sure, is it sort of triggered. People sat around and said, they heard about this, and it didn't sound right. And I think one of the reasons was that in 1996, Congress deregulated the ownership of radio in this country. And it changed it so one company could buy as many radio stations in the country as it wanted and could own up to 8 in a single community. And radio, I think, as most listeners to this station, that's probably why they're listening to this station, know it's been turned upside down in the last 7 years. We've done programs on it here. You know, you've got a few companies that own all the stations. The amount of advertising has gone up. The amount of local content has virtually disappeared. It's nothing short of a disaster what's happened to radio. And in effect, what these June 2nd FCC rules are going to do is do to the rest of our media system what's happened to radio. And people have a visceral reaction. They say, boy, this is really a clunker that happened with radio. Why do we want to let television and newspaper go down the same path when it's our own rules, our own airwaves that we're talking about? It's, you know, we control this. Why should we be doing this?
What's interesting is the reaction of the large media corporations to these arguments. They say that, you know, there's plenty of diversity on the airwaves and in newspapers and you know, radio and television and cable. And now the internet opens up even more opportunity for diverse voices. And so they say they need to have the rules change so that they can compete in this more competitive environment.
Yeah, I can. I'm proud of you. You said that with a straight face, you know, because it's really, if you think about it, it sounds so impressive. Yeah, gosh, poor Tribune Company up there in Chicago. You know, there's all these people like in Skokie who've got websites now. They're probably really sweating bullets in the Tribune headquarters about these people with websites in high schools in suburban Chicago. They're really probably going out of business now. You know, there's a lot of truth to – there's a half-truth to that, which is why it's compelling and why the first time you hear it and Rush Limbaugh says, oh, yeah, of course. They've got to let these guys become really huge so they can snuff out the threat of competition. That's the American way. But when you think about it, it doesn't really add up because the real truth of that, there's an empirical measure of how much new competition there is and how much that threatens these companies. And the empirical measure is simply this. If, in fact – giving these monopoly radio and TV licenses to companies like the Tribune Company, if in fact they no longer gave great monopoly power, if in fact they no longer had a lot of market power, a lot of wealth associated with them, if in fact there was so much competition that they weren't worth that much anymore, you would expect a couple of things to take place. One, you would expect these companies to be dumping them. You'd be walking out in the street and Rupert Murdoch be handing to you, hey, pal, come over here. I got a hot TV channel for you. He'd be glad to unload them. So, you'd buy these because all these internet sites coming along. This isn't going to be worth anything very soon. Instead, Rupert Murdoch wants to buy more and more. The other thing, and this is the really hard empirical fact that's undeniable, the market has voted. If, in fact, these channels weren't worth anything more because there's all this new competition, if, in fact, radio and TV channels, instead of being beachfront property at the media or just grains of sand on the media beach, you'd expect the value of the stations to come down. People would be unloading them. No one would want to buy them. They'd be plummeting. That would be the empirical evidence of that argument. In fact, the exact opposite has taken place. The value of radio and TV channels has increased dramatically in the last 7 years, much more than the rate of economic growth in the economy, much more than the rate of inflation. And as long as that's the case, it's a preposterous argument. It's purely ideological and propagandistic. These guys know those things are gifts from heaven. That's why they're trying to buy all of them.
We're talking this morning with Bob McChesney. He's professor at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois. He's also the host of Media Matters here on WILL that airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. and author of several books, Rich Media, Poor Democracy is his most recent book published by the New Press, and also a book that is considered a classic in the history of American broadcasting, Telecommunications, Mass Media, and Democracy. And we're talking about the recent ruling by the FCC opening up the cross-ownership of media properties by large corporations and the battle in Congress over that. And we have one caller waiting. Would welcome others. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, a listener from Champaign County on line number one. Okay. Good morning.
Hi there. The reason why I think it's come to this now, this incredible revolt and making Bush consider a veto for his media cronies, is the long-standing work of yourself, Chomsky, manufacturing consent, the whole the way that people have been concentrating on this for a while. But I think the war coverage was sort of the tipping point, perhaps, because it was just, to a lot of people's minds, incredibly jingoistic. I mean, had a very great impact. In fact, Bush says it's part of the reason for the downturn in the economy, all this war talk, so forget about it now, I guess. But I wanted your comment on that, and then I also wanted to mention that since I'm preoccupied with public TV and public radio's participation in, let's say, self-censorship and that sort of thing, and corporate boosterism is another way of putting it. I noted that on National Business Report, which is, I guess, public TV out of Miami, they announced yesterday they're having Powell on this evening. So I don't know if they had something in the can prior to this vote this morning or whether he's trying to get his script together right now.
I'm talking about Chairman Michael Powell of
FCC.
FCC
Commish is supposed to be on at 5:30 tonight. So I was already interested in seeing that, what he's going to say and what his posture is. I don't expect a lot of insight, but it'll be interesting to see how he reacts to this, I guess. There's been calls for his resignations all along, and there's been a rumor that he was considering it, but I don't think you do that on the business news. But I wanted to share that and also just say that I think that it's been a long haul of work on these media issues, but it's also the fact that it's just gotten so in-your-face blatant with the faux news and that sort of thing. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, you know, I think the point that the caller made about war coverage is absolutely right. I think what happened with the coverage of the war in Iraq, especially the build-up to the war now, before the war, when back then, and now it seems like we're talking about the War of the Roses, it seems so long ago, but back then people might remember the two main reasons we were told we were going to war was that this was about stopping the imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction, which were a threat to the people of this country, and two, breaking up the terrorist network of al-Qaeda, which was said to be linked closely to the Iraqi regime, to the point where the administration suggested strongly that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had been somehow connected to the 9/11 attacks and left this strong impression, did nothing to dissuade the American people of that. And both of these, we now know, are bogus claims. Both of these were actually apparently bogus to anyone who wanted to look at them critically prior to the war. And I think a lot of Americans who were studying these issues were offended that they weren't getting challenged sufficiently in our news media, that too often people in power were able to make these statements and not have them questioned, not be demanded to provide evidence for them. And in something like war, it really shocked people, combined with the fact that to many people, and I would put myself in this camp, that the war coverage was so jingoistic. It was not only not asking tough questions, it was in fact hostile towards people who did ask tough questions. So it was a very undemocratic environment to make the most important decision any democracy makes. It's like being railroaded into this war. And I think this is what stimulated the group Move On, for example, to take an issue, an interest in this media ownership issue. And in Move On, they've got a couple million people on their email list. And it wasn't like the leaders of Move On knew anything about this issue or cared about it. In fact, I work closely with them. They know nothing about the issue. They don't really care that much about it. But their membership said, this is the most important thing. We can't let Clear Channel and Rupert Murdoch and these guys buy up all the newspapers and media in this country. We have to stop it. Look at the lousy coverage of the war. And it's been absolutely foundational to what we've done because it has meant that we've gotten we've gotten 300,000 names last week in just 2 days through petitions, but we've generated over 3 million phone calls, letters, emails in the past 4 months to the FCC and Congress. And I think the Move On's responsible for a good chunk of those. But at the same time, interestingly enough, a lot of the support comes from people who are pro-war. I mean, we joke now, and it's only a half joke, that people think that this media reform movement that we're part of is a conservative movement. You know, is there a place for liberals or progressives in this movement? Because our leading figures now in the Senate is Trent Lott. If someone told me a year ago I'd be in bed with Trent Lott, I would have said it's absolutely unthinkable. Just last night, we got a letter of support from, and I can't believe I'm saying these words, Jesse Helms. William Sapphire of the New York Times writes column after column against media concentration. The National Rifle Association, Wayne LaPierre, one of our biggest allies, they've generated hundreds of thousands of signatures. And the reason why the National Rifle Association is opposed to media concentration isn't because the people who run the NRA are into this issue. It's their rank and file. People in Tennessee and Arkansas and in Illinois saying, we don't like the idea of having big companies own all the media in this country. That's not the way it should be. And so it's really been across the political spectrum. So the anti-war stuff has been part of it, but there's also been more than that. It's really a deep-seated process. Now, finally, on the point about Michael Pollan and PBS, PBS, like the commercial media, are conflicted on this. They have to go before both Congress and the Federal Communications Commission to get important rulings concerning licenses, concerning the transition to digital television and digital radio. They can't afford to be in a really hostile relationship with Michael Pollan. They're in a compromised position with him, and I think it means that they're going to bend over backwards to make sure he gets what he regards as fair treatment.
Okay. We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go next to a listener in Chicago on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Mr. McChesney, or Professor McChesney, I listened to your show on Sunday, and you always ask a wonderful question. You always ask your guests, where are they getting their information from? And what I find amazing is Sunday after Sunday, your very articulate guests turn inarticulate, and almost always they're mumbling or they can't quite form an answer, or it's like you're pulling it out, and I've always wondered about that. That's the first question. What do you think causes that? The second question is, I find something really confusing. I'm wondering if you would talk about how information is disseminated to the national media, because shortly after the war, when they were first doing sort of the body counts of soldiers killed in Iraq, the number all of a sudden changed in the end of May. It was like it was a bean count, and it went to zero. And in fact, I had a copy of the Christian Science Monitor where in the article the gentleman said that 50 people have been soldiers have been killed since the end of hostilities. And in the back, the editorial said less than 19. And I noticed in the last few days, WBBM Radio here in Chicago has broken from that, and they're giving the count as 157 since the end of major hostilities. And they're really the only ones who are giving that number. So was there some sort of official word sent out from the Pentagon or something that all the news media followed and they changed the count?
Well, let me start with your first part of that question. You know, I do ask my guests oftentimes, where do they get their information? Because I think a lot of our listeners want to know, and I sort of want to know, you know, where do you learn all this stuff so I can get on top of it too? Because I think there's a lot of frustration with the coverage in our news media of a lot of issues like the war, like the second half of this question. And it is interesting. A lot of maybe I should tip them off ahead of time. I catch them by surprise so they can come up with a really intelligent sounding answer, because a lot of the guests don't really have a quick answer. And I think part of that is that it is difficult with this plethora of media we have, that you always hear this blizzard of choices out there. It's difficult to name great media that you can rely on. And I think what happens is most our guests, like myself, rely on sort of a panoply of media that you piece together to try to come up with something. And it takes a lot of work. It's not easy. It means, in my case, I'll give you a sense how I would answer that, and you get what I mean by that. I read extensively, because of my interest in media, all the trade press for the media industry, and I read all the business press, and that's where you get a lot of very reliable information. But it's covered from a certain vantage point, certain set of values that aren't really constructive and are really poorly poor assistance on a lot of issues like foreign policy. I also read the national elite media, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and things like that. And I read extensively what's called the independent or alternative media, both online and in print, The Nation, The Progressive, In These Times, Mother Jones, and all sorts of websites like Common Dreams, Counterpunch. But, you know, the fact of the matter is there's not just one or two great media. I say, well, if I read these two things, I'm covered. I'm set. And I don't think I don't know if that's good or bad, but I think it's a sign that our media isn't as good as it should be. I think we ought to have a couple of media say, wow, you know, I consume one or two things, and that gives me a pretty reliable handle on the world. I think it's a source of great frustration for listeners mm-hmm. and our guests, and I suspect for you too.
Yes, okay.
Now, as for the second part, mm-hmm. You know, I think the point you're getting at there is that this war in Iraq, and I think our guest on Sunday, if you heard Danny Schechter talk about it, You know, the war is war today in the United States is as much a propaganda war as it is a war on a battlefield. It's what you make the people in the country think is in this country is as important as what the truth is in on the ground in Iraq. So to the administration, you know, this war has always been about selling it. Remember when they wanted to launch the war, the great line that slipped out from the White House. Someone said, you know, why are you waiting to September last year to sort of introduce your campaign against Iraq? And the White House advisor said, well, you never launch a new product in August. You know, it was clearly a campaign they were organizing around what we now know, and they, we know they knew, were bogus claims about terrorism and weapons of mass destruction. They couldn't believe it. Their own intelligence told them it wasn't true. But they wanted this war for other reasons, and unfortunately our news media did a poor job of trying to get at what those reasons are. They still have. But the point of it is that since the war ended, it hasn't ended. I mean, right now the period we're in is every bit as important as before or during the war. It's how people perceive this war. And the administration is working overtime to make it look like it has been a dramatic victory, that things are coming together quickly. We're gonna have a great regime in Iraq that loves us. It's just a matter of working out a few of the kinks. And one thing that undermines this picture dramatically is the idea that lots of Americans are getting killed by the people we've just liberated on a daily basis. And so it's imperative to keep that figure as low as possible, to spin it so the deaths are made to be outside agitators who sort of snuck into Iraq after the liberation because they don't like freedom-loving people like Americans. And I think, you know, this is a real effort to sort of shape the news. And I think it's good journalists are resisting it. They're doing their best, but they're under tremendous pressure to go with the flow. And I'd like to think we've had enough of a break where the disconnect between the sort of heroic victory on the aircraft carrier of President Bush is contradicted by the story after story coming out of Iraq that's carried in the international news. That presents a very different picture of a country in complete disarray, of hardly a victory lap that we're running in that country, but maybe a lap of desperation. And so I think honest journalists seeing this, it's hard for them to continue sort of parroting the idea that things are just great.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for your program. I really enjoy listening to it.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go next to a listener on line number one on a cell phone. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Good morning. I just have two quick questions. Mm-hmm. I got an email this morning about the editorial and The Economist over the weekend, kind of saying how opposition to modernization of our ownership rules is wrongheaded. I thought it was kind of interesting how they keep describing our media as a bewildering choice and how it's a free-for-all and there's so many choices, which I think you've already talked about how that's not really the case. I mean, many corporations own a lot of different channels, say on TV. It's not necessarily that much of a choice between different companies. It's maybe a little bit of different choice between content, but especially when you're talking about news, you have NBC, CNBC, MSNBC, it's all the same company. So I just kind of wanted to see what you had to say about this editorial that is urging Bush on to change the rules. And then I also wanted to ask how you see indie media, which I think is becoming, if a subdued player, but yet a player in the media game, how you see their place?
Yeah, those are terrific questions. The Economist magazine, a British magazine, like much of the business press, is in favor of relaxing these ownership rules. And I think they start from a philosophical position, which makes perfect sense of their position. And it's an erroneous position, but it makes sense if you accept their presupposition. Their presupposition is that the media system is built up heroically by the private sector, and the government just comes along later and sort of interferes with it and gets in the way and interrupts with the genius of a free market. That is a fairy tale that has absolutely nothing to do with our media system and how it developed. Our media system is the direct result of explicit government subsidies and policies that created it. The reason why WGN is the property of the Chicago Tribune isn't some heroic Horatio Alger story of Colonel McCormick. It's because he had a lawyer go to Washington who paid a lot of money, and they got this monopoly license out of the government without anyone else getting a crack at it. And there were lots of other people in Chicago who would have liked to have had that license, including the Chicago Federation of Labor. They weren't allowed to have it because Colonel McCormick had the best lawyer in America go to Washington behind closed doors, come away with that license. So our media system isn't some natural free market garden. In fact, it's set up by government policies and government subsidies, government licenses. And the real issue isn't regulation versus deregulation. There's no such thing as deregulation in this system. They say radio is deregulated, but I'll tell you what, you go try to broadcast on WGN and say, hey, it's deregulated. Now it's my turn to use this frequency. You do that, you do 20 years of hard labor in a federal penitentiary. The issue is whether it's regulation on behalf of the general public or regulation on behalf of corporate interests that steal their rights behind closed doors in sort of corrupt practices. And the economist doesn't see it that way. And if you see it the way I see it, then their argument collapses. It's nonsensical. And, you know, what you get out of the business community, though, are really, and out of the media corporations themselves, are two sets of arguments. One set is the set the economist gives and that you hear politicians use, and that is spewed out by the likes of Rush Limbaugh. Oh, these poor companies are going out of business. They're all this competition. It's so hard. There's all these choices for everyone. This is this world of this blizzard of options. These poor companies can barely survive. And isn't everyone happy with how wonderful the system is, except for the companies who are suffering? The other side, though, the truth is what they tell their Wall Street analysts and the investment bankers, and what you can also read in the business press, is the exact opposite. And the Wall Street Journal on its front page yesterday morning had a wonderful piece talking about this. Go to that piece when you read The Economist, talking about how companies like GE that just bought Vivendi, their Universal Studios, or Viacom, or Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, have met the challenge of new technologies by not only owning television networks in the United States, like NBC, Fox, ABC, and CBS, but they also own all the major film studios. They own most of the cable channels. They own, you know, music companies. They've assembled these enormous conglomerates. So you might have a lot more choices, but they own most of them. I mean, they still dominate our media culture, and that's the genius that they've had. And far from suffering, these companies are doing just great, thank you. They are raking in money, and they're raking it in because they're getting these wonderful licenses, these monopoly franchises to cable systems, these monopoly franchises to TV channels and radio channels that the government gives for free and enforces the monopoly rights. It's a government-created system. So the truth is, if you look at when they're trying to raise money and they're trying to get investors to give them money, they tell them they're doing great, thank you, and they really locked up the market. When they're trying to get politicians to give them cushy deals, then all of a sudden they're suffering and they're poor and they can barely compete. I think the truth is what they're telling people when they want their money.
I would agree.
As for indie media, the second part of your question, I love indie media. I think it plays a wonderful place in our society. I wouldn't over-romanticize it, though. And by that, I mean, to do good media, journalism, culture, entertainment, takes resources. It takes people who can do it for a living. You know, don't just work in a coal mine, feed their kids, you know, clean up their house. Then they sit down and do their website at 11 o'clock at night before they fall asleep. It takes resources. It takes institutional support. And indie media is great, but, you know, you need resources. And I think that we need to have constructive public policies to come up with ways to build a viable nonprofit, non-commercial, pluralistic sector if we're going to have a truly healthy independent media sector.
Based on indie media, do you see it in the future? Or
I think indie media is part of, I think it's part of the solution, a definite part of it, but not the entirety of it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Okay,
thanks very much for the call. One of the issues, you know, we keep using this word competition, and it seems to me that maybe sometimes, you know, the industry is using the word in a different way than maybe you or I might. I think of competition in the media as competition of ideas, that it's really important to have great journalism, as you were just talking about, great cultural, political productions, whether it's, on the news or public affairs or, you know, entertainment. And I guess for the people who are citizens and, consumers and people who are members of the community and democracy, competition to them is competition of ideas. And I think competition in the industry is competition of dollars and ratings.
You know, it's even beyond that. I think you're right. And I think that that's why sometimes people say, they talk about this plethora of choices. Well, to the average American in February or March of this year, as we're talking about going to war in Iraq, they're saying, where are these choices? I'm going from CNN to CNBC to Fox to my local news, and all I'm getting is a bunch of flag-waving people who aren't asking any tough questions of the president or swallowing basically hook, line, and sinker what we're being told. What we now know were lies. And so there isn't any competition there. We might have 5,000 voices out there, but if no one's spreading, stretching it out, there it seems like you might as well have one voice. It might as well be Pravda for all intents and purposes. So you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's really the measure of a competitive system is there's a real range of ideas, not just that there are 15 people telling you the exact same thing. But also, I think the way these companies use the term competition is misleading because if you've studied economics, just the first week of any introductory economics class, what you learn is a competitive market is a very special creation. A competitive market means that someone can enter the market if they want easily. There are low barriers to entry. So if you don't like what's being produced in a market, you don't have to sit there and suffer. You can start your own company, enter the market, and produce an alternative and see if people want it. Media markets are not competitive in the economic sense of the term. None of them. They're what are called traditionally oligopolistic markets. There are a handful of giant companies that dominate. And if you don't like what those four or five companies give you, there's nothing you can do about it except pick between them or not be in the market. You can't start a new film studio. You can't start a new TV network. You can't start a new viable music company or newspaper. Certainly can't start a new daily newspaper in any community in this country. No one's been able to start one in 80 years. So they're not competitive markets. And you know, so they use the rhetoric of competitive markets to justify their control over the media system. Yeah, we're giving the people what they want. But in fact, what they have are non-competitive markets. And with the rules changes they're trying to get pushed through right now, they're going to make them vastly less competitive than they already are.
We're talking this morning with Bob McChesney. He's a professor at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, author of several books on media and democracy, his most recent, Rich Media, Poor Democracy. He's also the host of Media Matters here on WILL Radio, airs Sunday at 1 p.m. Actually, your most recent book is Our Media, Not Theirs.
That's right.
Should have mentioned that.
Thank you. Yeah, my publisher will be happy.
All right. And that's published by Seven Stories Press. And Rich Media, Poor Democracy, I said New Press, but it's actually U of I Press, isn't
it? U and I U of I published the cloth edition in 1999, then New Press published the paper edition with a new introduction the following year.
Okay. Well, I wanted to get that straight. Our lines are all full, so let's go on and talk to some more callers. Next up, a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to get ad hominem for just a moment. And my perception is that Michael Powell led this charge rather dogmatically and very forcefully and wouldn't listen to arguments against this, quote, deregulation. I wonder if you could give me some insight into what Michael Powell's motivation was in taking this very, very hard line, and then I'll hang up and just listen. Thank you very much.
You know, Michael Powell, who's the son of Colin Powell, it's a nepotism appointment. He's being groomed by the Republicans. He's a very young man to have some sort of political career in the party, and everyone knows that. You know, Michael Powell, in a way, I have a lot of sympathy for him, in a way. Don't worry, not too much. But, you know, he probably looks at all his predecessors running the FCC. And basically, for the most part, the FCC is a body that operates outside of the public eye, and it serves as an agency that is captured by the industry it regulates. His predecessor, Democrat William Kennard, now makes seven-figure income working for the Carlyle Group, brokeraging telecom deals. And that's par for the course. People go to the FCC, they work it, they learn the industry, then they go on and make a fortune as a lobbyist or a lawyer for the industry. The whole thing is corrupt, you know, but it's not entirely corrupt in the sense that they're bought and paid for. And really, the way William Kennard explained it to me when I interviewed him, he said that when he became head of the FCC, he went out to breakfast with all the previous heads of the FCC in Washington. They all live there. They're all lobbyists now or lawyers for communication firms. And he said, what do you do to be successful head of the SEC? And, you know, I want to really serve the public. And they looked at him like he was stoned. Serve the public? Where are you from, pal? And so one of them pulled him aside and said, son, I got some news for you. If you're head of the FCC, what you do is you're refereeing fights between the super, super rich and the super, super, super rich. And the key is if you give one side a benefit one week, give them the license. The next week, you give the other side the regulation. You play them off against each other. Don't be seen as just being in one side all the time. So you're playing off the phone companies to the cable companies, the TV networks to the film studios. And Kennard said, yeah, and that's basically what it is. You're just basically refereeing fights between very wealthy special interest lobbies. And that's the business, and no one knows about it. And you get pressure from Congress because the lobbyists work on Congress. And I think what happened was Powell took over the job and said, hey, this is the way it works, and I'm just going to serve wealthy private interests and make them rich and spew out some free market mumbo-jumbo press releases and give a couple talks to the Kiwanis Club and move on and live happily ever after. Little did he know that he would get caught up in this hurricane that is unprecedented. No other FCC members ever faced anything like this. 3 million people monitoring what you do. Suddenly, he spews out some nonsense about how the FCC is neutral and experts, and they're scientific, and they don't have any they're not taking positions. They're just implementing the will of the Congress. He spews this stuff out, and in the past, people at FCC would say that, and people wouldn't even question it. Now, if you say, how can you possibly say that? They say, let's see your studies you've done. They look at the studies, and they're a joke. They say, why haven't you gotten any public input? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. He doesn't have an answer. And all his arguments collapse because he's been given a degree of scrutiny no previous FCC members had. He's a very sad case because, on one hand, he claims to be a neutral scientific expert, although he knows nothing about the subject. On the other hand, when he's pushed, he becomes the most blatant propagandist for big media, spewing out their press releases without any critical eye whatsoever. And I think when you boil it down, what you see with Michael Pollan, it's the same thing you see with the Bush administration. This is nothing about principle, because as I said, this is nothing to do with free markets. That's why so many conservatives are opposed to this. It's all about corrupt politics. This is payback time for the huge media companies that have been favorable to the Bush administration. Clear Channel, Viacom, which is just run on Showtime, this hagiography to Bush on 9/11, Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, the Tribune Company. This is payback time. These guys want this. They helped get George elected. They're going to get him reelected. He wants to deliver the goods for them. This is what they want.
Now, quick follow-up, and then we'll take some more calls. The vote on the FCC on June 2nd was 3-2. There were two commissioners in opposition, and I remember hearing one of those people in opposition on the FCC on your show, Media Matters, Michael Copps.
Correct.
And I know that he was speaking around the country against this proposed ruling for some time. So, I guess my question is, is the FCC itself a hopeless case, or is there a chance of it making some sort of democratic decisions?
I think it's a very good point, because people talk about the FCC like it was just a slam dunk. These are five guys in the pocket of industry. In fact, it was a heavily contested 3-2 vote. Copps and Adelstein, the other no vote, they didn't hold hearings against this. They actually held hearings on it. They went around to 14 cities around the country with no support from the government. They did it at their own expense or from people around the country, usually colleges and universities almost everywhere, sponsoring events that heard both sides of the story and took public testimony. Said, this is too important, the idea of letting one company own all the media in a town, to do it without hearing what the people in these towns actually think about it. And they held these public hearings. Michael Pollan refused to go to any of them. He said, I'm too busy here in Washington going through all this scientific data. I don't have time to go out and talk to people. But there's a good reason he didn't go out there, because what Copps found and Adelstein found in these public hearings is that 99.9% of the people who came were opposed to having more media concentration, opposed to this. And Paul didn't want to be this, because he's had this mind made up before this. It's apparent before anything happened, it was clear where he was going to come down. So the more he had this sort of exposure, the more difficult it would be for him to pull this off and get away with it.
Okay. Several callers waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Charleston on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, I'll make it real quick. Some time ago, I saw a program about Rupert Murdoch, and they referred to him as a pirate at the end of the program. His tactics and all that occurred after he left Australia, I think. But the stinger is that he was Johnny Come Lately, that everything that your guest has been describing was vintage, and here he come, trying to break into something that was already a done deal, in my opinion. I'll hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call.
It's easy to revile Rupert Murdoch, and I do it periodically myself, or the head of Tribune Company or Clear Channel or any of these firms, Viacom. But I want to caution, too, that it's really not about good or bad people or good or bad companies, really. If I was a shareholder in Clear Channel or Tribune Company or Viacom or News Corporation, Rupert Murdoch's company, I was judging whether I'm making more money in that investment or buying investment in an automobile company or a steel company, I would applaud what they're doing. They're doing exactly what they should be doing. They're trying to make as much money as possible for their shareholders. That's their job, and that's what I'd want them to do. My goal is just to make as much money as possible. The criminals here are the politicians and the regulators who give them the ability to do this. I mean, because the criminals are the ones who let these public policy be warped corruptly to suit their private interests. And that's really where we should be aiming our fire. It's the members of Congress saying, don't let this go on. Stop it. They're doing, these policies that they're taking advantage of are being made in our name, but without our informed consent. You're ignoring us. And that's really where, why the attention goes to Washington. Yelling and screaming at Rupert Murdoch isn't going to solve our problems. If Rupert Murdoch were to become a hippie and move to Tibet and smoke dope the rest of his life, his company probably wouldn't change a bit, whoever replaced him, whether the person, they'd be doing the exact same things, maybe not as well. But, you know, it's not that he's a bad guy or a good guy that determines that company. It's broader structural forces. The structure is created by government policies. The crucial thing is to make those policies represent the will of the people, not the will of powerful special interests.
Yeah. The power of the special interests, though, is the power of money in Washington in large part. Is it not?
I mean, this is
essentially how, and this is the part where, you know, democracy disconnects from the process.
That's right. And that's why this has been an amazing year, because what we're talking about, there's the great community organizer, Saul Alinsky, has a line. He says, when you're going up against organized money, you need organized people. You know, you can win. The degree of difficulty is very high against money. And if you don't have any publicity or any public involvement, money always wins. And it's a fight between money, like the canard was told. But once you get people introduced and 3 million people involved, letting members of Congress know, hey, we think this is important, for the first time in their lives, members of Congress might actually, when they run for an election next year, hear about this. Tim Johnson is going to hear, how come you voted for these media bosses? You know, he got a lot of people from this district, called him up, said, don't do this. I got no one from this district, I bet, called him up, said, Tim, we want to have fewer media owners. But he ignored them. And he's going to answer that for the first time in his career. Now we're going to have a whole new dynamic. What happens when politicians have to answer for these votes? In the past, they never did. And maybe now they'll pay more attention. I mean, if you get enough people who care, you can begin to win. It's a sloped playing field, but the field still is there.
Let's take some more calls. We have a listener waiting patiently on line number 3 from Champaign next. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Jack. Good to hear you on the air. And Bob, good to hear you as well. I listen to your show all the time. Two quick comments. One about the whole free markets and people having lots of choice. The media market, to me, it seems kind of like an Italian restaurant. You walk into an Italian restaurant, you might have 10 Italian dishes to choose from, but they're the ones the restaurant decides. And if you want Mexican, if you want French, if you want American food, you're not going to get it. Now, technically, you have freedom of choice. And they can go ahead and track, out of the 10 dishes, Italian dishes that they offer, you can track and say, oh, well, people love this dish, and so there are lots of choice. And people didn't choose that dish, so they had the right to choose. Well, it's still a limited menu that they decide. And that's just the way the media is. It's not this, well, we give the people what they want. The real, that's a chicken and egg kind of thing. The real situation to me is that the people have to take what they get. And we have to choose from what the media offers us. And if there is no, if everybody is offering the same menu, then we don't have freedom of choice. We have very limited choice. I don't know, just a little thought. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, just recently, I subscribed to a new newsletter, email newsletter that's out there called the Daily Mislead. And it's from MoveOn.com. They're kind of a...
.org.
.org. Thank you very much. They're very much an activist organization that wants to put politics back in the hands of the people versus the big institutions. And the Daily Mislead was specifically designed to inform reporters and the whole media community about what kind of things are really going. Their premise was the media is not questioning the Bush administration nearly enough. So they've decided they're going to just print every single day a little example of how the Bush administration is either not telling the truth or not representing the facts correctly or somehow misleading the American public. And the goal that they hope to accomplish is to get people to just ask questions. In the end, you may agree with the president. In the end, you may disagree. But if we don't ask the questions, it ain't democracy. And that was kind of an interesting thing. So that's the Daily Mislead from MoveOn.org. Anyway, just thought I'd mention that and give you a chance to chat about that a bit if you'd like. Thanks.
You know, we've only got a few minutes left. Let me say one thing before we go to the next caller,
sure,
if you could, Jack. You know, the vote today in the Senate, 55-40, to overturn what the SEC did, is not the final vote.
Right.
And I think, I don't want listeners to leave here saying, hey, let's go get the champagne, or if they like media constant, you know, if they want to have media monopolies, you know, get upset and cry. In fact, this has to go to the House and get passed there. The Speaker of the House, Hastert, has the ability to stop it from going to vote, so it probably won't even go to a vote in the House. The real issue is going to come back in the Senate. There's going to be a vote on this again in another forum probably later this month or early October. And then ultimately what it almost certainly is going to come down to is an appropriations bill rider in the Senate that will overturn it, so they won't fund it. And then it'll go to what's called a conference committee. And this sounds very confusing, I know. It confuses all of us. But the bottom line is it'll go to a conference committee to reconcile both the House and Senate appropriation bills. And in those negotiations, it'll be decided whether to throw this out or not. And that's why the political fight is just beginning. It hasn't ended. This is like, it's sort of like we're in the, you know, the end of the preseason's over now and the regular season's about to start. And what I would urge listeners who are concerned about this, sign the petition that Move On and a bunch of other groups have done. And the where you can go is if you go to the website, mediareform.net, you'll see a petition there that goes to all members of Congress saying, we want you to overturn this the SEC's media ownership relaxation. Just go to mediareform.net. And it's really the next month is crucial. It's not over if you're interested in this. The fight's just beginning. Our chances of victory are very good, but they're only good when we have support. If people get complacent, we'll lose.
We have a couple other calls to talk with, and let's go next to a listener in Peoria on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. Well, we also support moveon.org and are on that misleading email list. Sunday, I was listening to Meet the Press. Cheney flat out made a false statement, namely that we have two mobile biological warfare labs that we discovered that the Iraqis have, which in fact are hydrogen generators for Iraqi balloons sold to them by the British. And we had Tim Russert lamely saying, well, there's some debate about that. How do we get American reporters to become like the BBC reporters and really challenge the people they're interviewing?
Well, this is one way it would happen is if we had a more diverse media system. I mean, that's not the only solution, but it doesn't help that we have our leading commercial broadcasters, our handful of companies, who are all dependent basically on this administration. Now they're lobbying them to get these rules relaxed. It's a conflict of interest. That won't solve the problem, but that would be a good place to start. And another issue outside of media that would influence this strongly would be if the Democratic Party, the sort of official opposition, was more vociferous in its opposition throughout this, instead of being going along with it meekly for the most part, then journalists would have a little more official sources to draw from who are critical, because journalists basically hide behind official sources. They don't want to have their own necks out in the line. That's why they're scared to death to ask tough questions to Bush or Cheney, unless they can say, as Tim Russert said, well, Senator so-and-so said this, criticizing you. What do you say to that? Tim Russert doesn't have the guts to say, I think you're full of it. You're lying. That would be considered unprofessional in the way our professionalism is determined in the United States journalism. I think it's unfortunate. It means we have a journalism that's very much hostage to the debates of people in power. And if you try to step outside those debates, you're considered unprofessional.
Well, the same thing goes for Jim Lehrer on the NewsHour.
Absolutely. No, they're all a bunch of cowards. And I think that changing the media system will help, and also if we had an opposition party that actually opposed and that really stood up and opposed and slammed their fist on the table, that might help some journalists locate their backbone.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We're almost out of time. We have a couple people we won't be able to include. I just want to put in a plug for Bill Moyers as one of those who has not given up asking the tough questions.
Bill Moyers, I'm his number one fan in the world. Yeah. He's an extraordinarily brave and courageous man, and I think it's a credit to PBS. And I've been very critical of PBS. I know some of your listeners are. It's a credit to PBS that they fight against tremendous pressure to keep him on the air.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we just have about a minute left. You mentioned that the battle continues. 3 million people have voiced their opinion on this.
That's right. And after today's show, 3,000,025, I hope.
Right. So it goes next, the Senate has spoken.
The Senate's going to have to speak again. It's really, I think, it's both sides of Congress are going to visit this again, but the Senate side is still really the crucial side. The House voted on this stuff last month, or in August, actually, in late July, and they're pretty much through with it for the time being.
Okay, so if people want to get more information, you mentioned mediareform.net.
Yeah.
You want to mention that you founded this thing called Free Press.
Yeah, it's a group, and we've been working very closely with Move On. We actually write all the petitions and do all the work for them. And working with Consumers Union and Common Cause, the National Rifle Association, we have a huge coalition. Our good friend Trent Lott and Jesse Helms in with us, and Jesse Jackson and the National Organization of Women. It's an extraordinary coalition of Americans across the political spectrum who all agree in one thing. It's not good to have media monopoly.
We'll leave it there for now. We will return to the subject, I promise. And our guest again has been Bob McChesney. He's professor at the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois, author of several books, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy, a book published by the University of Illinois Press, and also Our Media, Not Theirs, published by Seven Stories Press. He's also the host of a show you can hear on Sundays here on WILL AM. It's called Media Matters. And Bob McChesney, thanks once again for being here.
My pleasure, Jack.